Welcome to the Spirituality of Strength Training with your host, Anna Willard. This podcast is dedicated to bring you knowledge, wisdom, inspiration, and guidance to wherever you may be on your health journey. For those who are new to me, I am a kettlebell strength coach, a movement nerd ninja, and an empowerment coach on a mission to bring you hope through our health. The root word of health comes from wholeness. The root word of wholeness comes from holy. Despite our differences with religion and spiritual beliefs, we are all human beings with a body that is designed to reflect this holiness through our health. It wasn't until my 7th year as a health profession where I went into a deep awakening of understanding what does it mean to train my spirit and to heal my spirit through the physical. You'll hear a little bit more about my story from other health professionals, from strength coaches, psychiatrists, spiritual gurus and leaders, to other people who talk about the importance of our health as a community body and the health of our planet as well. This podcast is to allow us to step into our whole health, mentally, physically, emotionally, and spiritually. Thank you for being here. If you love what you hear, I encourage you to subscribe. If you want more inspiration and quotes from these podcasts, I encourage you to follow me on Instagram at @Anna_Willard_. I encourage you to do a little bit of a movement, either a yoga flow, go for a walk, sit in nature, as you enjoy this episode. Hey, Strong Ones, welcome to today's show. Today we have James Brown on the show with us today. He is a meditation guru. He teaches two different types of meditations. I learned the Vedic meditation from him about 2-3 years ago. And then he also teaches a flow meditation, which I'm interested to hear the difference. James, welcome to the show.
Thanks so much.
Yeah, I'm really excited to have you. Yeah. And can you explain first to the listeners just the importance of meditation and the benefits of it? And then we'll dive into the difference of the types that you teach.
Okay. So let's talk just really broadly about the benefits of meditation.
Yeah.
Because I think of meditation as a very core practice. Mm-hmm. I came to this understanding and a way of describing meditation when I was teaching a class of 25 fitness trainers to meditate. And we were talking about different types of meditation and meditation overall. And what I explained is that while your abs and lower back might be considered your physiological core, right? Mm-hmm. That deeper than that, your core as a human being is consciousness. Mm-hmm. We experience everything through consciousness, every decision, every emotion, every plan, every success, every failure, all of that is experienced in consciousness. In fact, you know, we might live lives full of doingness, right? We're a very busy, active, to-do list, task-oriented culture, but Wikipedia still hasn't changed the description of our species to human doing. We're still human beings, and being is a state mm-hmm. of consciousness. Mm-hmm. So I think meditation is a practice, and there are different types of meditation, that its real purpose at some fundamental level is to both expand and polish that lens of consciousness through which you experience everything. And when I say expand and polish, that implies, of course, that sometimes it can get really constricted and mm-hmm. dirty. Mm-hmm. And I think that everyone can relate to that. There are times in life where I have this very sort of narrow, angry view of life, and I don't have a lot of clarity. And so meditation practices are practices that work to reverse that, right? Mm-hmm. Expand and polish.
I like it. Would you say it gives flexibility to the mind then?
Yeah, it gives. Yes, I would absolutely say flexibility, openness, flexibility, however yeah. you want to think about it. Because, you know, when we've all been in situations where we feel trapped, where we only see one way you know, out of a situation or no ways out of a situation. Mm-hmm. And it's really just because you're stressed out and pinned into this little trap.
Right.
So, you know, so the meditation absolutely is about mental flexibility. It's about resilience. It's about openness, all of those kinds of things.
Nice. Now, how did you get involved into this? First as like just a practice for yourself, and then what motivated you to become a teacher of it?
So, my first foray into meditation happened in my mid-30s. So I'm, you know, pretty old now, almost 60. So that was a long time ago. But I first leapt into meditation because I wanted to be cooler. I thought more interesting women would be if I meditated. You know, I was unmarried then. I was trying to, you know, figure out what, you know, couch would look right in my place and what books would be good on my shelves. And, you know, I was kind of curating myself in this dating game that we sometimes play. Mm-hmm. And I just thought if I could say something like, oh, you know, I'm going to the Zen Center this weekend, if you're into that kind of thing. And so I leapt into Buddhism because I thought Buddha invented meditation. I thought there was this guy named Buddha, and that first name, nickname, I don't know, his last name. And he invented this thing called meditation. And even if I had never meditated before, I knew what that was, or I had an idea of what that was. Mm-hmm. The same way if people have never been to Paris, they have a pretty clear mental image of what that's going to be like. Mm-hmm. And so I thought meditation was about sitting like this, and your hands had to be in some sort of special position, and you sat with an erect spine, and you tried to make it really quiet and zen, whatever that meant for you, and you tried to clear my mind, right? Clear your mind. And so I tried that for about a year and a half before giving up, pretty convinced that my mind was too crazy to meditate. I liked a lot of the ideas of Buddhism, philosophies. I kept all the books. I even kept a little Buddha sculpture, but I basically gave up doing seated, eyes closed meditation because I thought my mind was too crazy. And that just didn't fit in my life. And it wasn't until much later in life when my life got really crazy. If any of your you know, listeners out there, watchers, viewers, I guess would be the term, have kids, we can all agree that kids, no matter how chaotic and stressed out you think your life is, adding a kid to it just, whoa, really ramps that up.
Yeah.
So we had adopted our first kid, and life got really crazy. And at the same time, I ended up having a really terrible job. A lot of struggle. My wife and I's relationship hit a pretty rocky place. The pressures of being parents and dredged up a lot of issues that we never thought we'd have to deal with. Mm. It was in that swirl of chaos I discovered that there was a different approach to meditation. Mm-hmm. And my wife and I took a course together, which was surprising because at that point she didn't really like me very much and wasn't really down with my suggestions. But for whatever reason, she's like, okay, fine, we'll take the course.
Oh, interesting.
Course together, and it just allowed some clarity, right? It allowed some stress to be released. It allowed some clarity, and we could see a way forward as a couple. And now we've been married almost 18 years. But that's what really put me on the path to meditation, is discovering there was a different approach to it. Mm. And, yeah.
Cool. Can you describe the Vedic approach and how that's a little bit different than what some people may view meditation or that viewpoint?
Yeah, absolutely. And I guess maybe the simplest way to say it is that there are three basic types of meditation.
Okay.
And I, you know, obviously we could spend a whole hour talking about these different types and different strains of meditation. And undoubtedly what I'm going to say, someone out there listening is going to be like, well, that's not quite right. Because of course someone is always wrong on the internet.
Right.
It's our job to fix it. So with that as a mea culpa, there are three basic types of meditation. The first is what I started with. You might call it focused concentration meditation, where the practice is about disciplining the mind, about developing a stronger focus or concentration to be able to maintain that focus despite distractions, to, you know, acknowledge thoughts and let them go, to have something that you anchor your focus on, like the breath or a mandala or something. And you basically sit in a particular way, getting better at being in control of your mind, I would say. That's how it was explained to me. I had different kinds of teachers, different degrees of austerity. Postural acuity was more important in some practices, less important in others. But it was really about focusing and concentrating, trying to tame what the Buddhists call the monkey mind. Mm-hmm. And as I said, I came to the conclusion after about a year and a half that my monkey was untrainable. I walked away because I thought, well, I can't do the thing they're asking me to do. And so I gave up.
Right.
There's another type of meditation, which is called contemplative practice, where, you know, most people think they have too many thoughts. And I don't think I've ever taught a person to meditate who's come to say, you know, I'm pretty good with the thoughts. I don't have too many, just about the right amount, right? Mm-hmm. Most people have too many thoughts and most people have too many negative thoughts. Nobody says I have too many happy thoughts. I'm here to meditate because I'm just too overflowing with great creative ideas or compassion for my fellow beings. You know, most people have too much negative self-talk, too much worry, anxiety. Mm-hmm. And so on the one hand, back to the Buddhist approach, you're trying to train the mind. Mm-hmm. And in this other practice, contemplative practice, I would say you're trying to curate your thinking. You're trying to have nicer thoughts, right? You'll contemplate compassion or forgiveness. And this can be in the form of reading something and then just sitting and reflecting on it. Or maybe there's a guided meditation and someone with a fairly nice voice will lead you through a series mm-hmm. of exercises asking you to visualize this or that. And there's guided meditations on abundance versus scarcity and connectedness versus disconnectedness and all kinds of things. But that idea of contemplative practice, you know, curating my thinking, having, if I have too many negative thoughts, maybe if I have nicer thoughts, I'll bring more of those qualities to my life. And it absolutely works as a practice. If you do it, if you do a gratitude practice, you'll be more grateful. Right? Mm-hmm. It absolutely works. These days, because of apps and the great proliferation of apps, that's mm-hmm. hard to say, we've kind of combined what you might think of as a mindfulness-based practice, and guided meditations, right? And so now we have people with nice voices guiding you along a path of focusing and concentrating. And then that leads into those same people or other people on the same apps then doing contemplative practices. So apps have become a delivery vehicle for both. I think one of the interesting things about apps is that if you go down the reflective path or the concentrative path for a while, you kind of get tired of the person's voice telling you to breathe. You're like, would you just shut up so I can meditate?
Yeah.
It's why I think I would say 70% of the people I've taught in the last couple of years have said things like, I was using Headspace for a while, but I was using Calm for a while. And there's this idea of maybe I could go a little deeper. Maybe I could benefit from having some live instruction or an engagement with a person that I can ask direct questions to. Mm-hmm. And so, yeah. And so those are those two types of practices, concentrative and contemplative. And then the Vedic approach, which has been called a number of things over the millennia, because it's a practice that is probably a couple thousand years older than Buddhism. They didn't keep really accurate date records back then, but it certainly predates Buddhism. And it's a practice that is all about allowing yourself to meditate. It's not about concentrating or focusing. It's not about trying to control the mind or have fewer thoughts or nicer thoughts. It's this fairly radical thing of where you sit comfortably, right? You don't sit in any kind of a meditator pose. You sit comfortably. Mm-hmm. Upright with back support, kind of like I'm sitting now. Like I have a couple pillows behind me. I'm sitting, you know, just on our bed actually against the wall. This is where I meditate almost every morning.
Yeah.
And I have low back support, but I'm not sitting in the open floor like a monk, right? Mm-hmm. Because I'm not a monk, as it turns out. And I don't have all day to meditate and practice my posture. And so you sit comfortably. If you're uncomfortable, you can move, you can scratch and sort of get relaxed. And you either use the breath, or you in a different kind of way than is typically done in meditation, or you use a mantra, like the class you took, the Vedic class you took, mm-hmm. you use a mantra. Mm-hmm. But you use a mantra that has a different quality. It's not a mantra that you repeat again and again and again. There is a practice that's based on having a mantra that you repeat over and over and over and over and over again. You might have a mala, like a Hindu rosary, mm-hmm. that you know, 108 beads on the rosary, on the mala, and you try to stay on the mantra the whole time. That's called japa mantra. We use a mantra, but in a different type of mantra, and we use it in a different way, which means we use the mantra not as a point of focus, but as a diving board, right? And sometimes when I'll teach an intro workshop, I'll have people use the breath like I would teach someone on a course, like the course you took, or the online flow course that I teach, to use a mantra. And so it's really, without getting too particular about what a mantra is and why it's useful and how exactly you use it, to compare it to the other practices, it's really a practice of allowing. It's allowing the mind to flow. Of instead of acknowledging thoughts and letting them go, you're willing to let the mantra or the breath go and allow the mind to flow. And that has some interesting implications and applications and reasons for doing it. So, yeah. And just to be clear, so the Vedic course, so the Vedic and flow meditation are essentially the same practice.
Okay.
But Vedic meditation is a term that I reserve for a very particular course that's taught live and in person. That's the course you took. And I have a number of colleagues around the world, and we've all kind of agreed that we'll use the term Vedic meditation to mean that in-person teaching.
Got it.
The Flow Meditation course is an online course. It teaches meditation, some breath work, some mindfulness, and some visualization. And it uses a mantra, but it uses a different class of mantra. And it's delivered online versus in person. And so I want to make that distinction. But it's the same approach to meditation, just offered in a different way.
Cool. Can you explain a little bit of the benefits of the right and left brain with the meditation and the process of like the flow and the allowance that this type of practice brings?
Absolutely. I love to talk about the brain because I think, you know, a lot of research is done on the brain. It's interesting because one of the biggest reasons that people, mostly guys, give this as the reason, come to learn to meditate is they're like, hey man, I'm here to meditate. That's my guy voice. Like my own voice isn't guy enough.
I was just gonna say, more the masculine voice.
So I guess I have to man it up to be the guy voice. Maybe I'll just use my regular voice. To say, hey man, I'm really here to learn to meditate because science is proving it works, and I'm fantastic. Right? But however, you do have to understand that it worked thousands of years before science could prove it, and it's giving you permission. And a lot of that research is done on the brain. And so, you know, you mentioned the left and right hemisphere. You know, there are certain meditation practices that light up certain parts of the brain very brightly, the compassion center, the prefrontal cortex. That reduce activity in something like the fear center, the amygdala. And I teach those practices, but that's not the core of what I teach. The Vedic approach, the flow approach to meditation, does something really interesting. I mean, I think it's all interesting.
Right.
But when we practice this allowing approach to meditation, this flow approach to meditation, the whole brain lights up, but not as brightly. And it's really interesting because, well, why is that good? As it turns out, that's what your brain looks like when you're experiencing what scientists call a flow state. And there are three groups of people that we don't normally put together that exhibit this very harmonious, very whole, very balanced brainwave state. Right? Because I teach in a lot of companies, and I teach in a lot of type A sort of, you know, super achiever types. And they're like, yeah, you know I need to be more right-brained. And I'm like, no, you need to be more whole-brained.
Yeah.
Right? If you've overemphasized a certain kind of left-brained critical analytical thinking, then we don't want to overcorrect, right? We don't want to turn against the skid. We don't want to then go into like right brain la la land. The whole brain works best when it works together. That's what it was designed for.
Right.
And to support this assertion, as I said, there's these three groups. So the first group, which is essentially in a flow state 24/7, is toddlers. Right, toddlers are in flow with the present moment. I mean, no one on this planet is more present than a 3-year-old, 4-year-old, and they don't have to go to meditation classes. Toddlers use their whole brain the whole time. They're open and available to everything, and it's why they're the super learners on this planet. Nobody learns anything faster, more flexibly, right, than a toddler. Then there are studies where they've taken jazz musicians and given them their instruments and put them in fMRI machines and all link them up with headphones and ask them to jam. And they can jam, they can improvise music, co-creating in real time in those crazy MRI machines, right? With this sort of, but you know, they got their headphones, they got their instruments, and they're just jamming away. And they make an extrapolation that that's what your brain looks like. So the jazz musician's brain looks strikingly like the toddler's brain when they're improvising.
Interesting.
And, you know, they make an extrapolation that that's what your brain looks like when you're experiencing a flow state. But they can't put a golfer in an MRI machine. They can't put a ballet dancer. They can't put an author. Right? There's all these things that we call flow states, you know, when an athlete is in the zone, when an author, when a work is just flowing through them. You know, there are other more ordinary experiences that I think rise to that experiential level that I would call a flow state. It, you know, a conversation, a really great conversation is a flow state. Essentially, I think a flow state, and I have this, I talk about this idea of everyday flow, because I think we need to grab that term flow and wrest it back from the peak experience chasers. Mm-hmm. There are people like, oh man, I was like in this ecstatic dance circle in Burning Man and it was like, you know, total flow. And I'm like, well, that's great. But what if you have kids? What if you're not going to Burning Man? You know, what if you're just at home? And I really think that anytime someone talks about being in a flow state, what they're really talking about, what they're really describing is being absolutely fully present, mm-hmm. right, of everything. And if you can be absolutely fully present for everything about a situation, that's a flow state. And that can be grating cheese, right? That can be washing the dishes. That can be like a hug without an agenda is a flow state.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
A hug with an agenda is not a flow state. Mm-hmm. What, yeah. And what makes that, like sex when you're in your head, not flow. Sex when you're not in your head, flow. Mm-hmm. And what makes that difference is the part about being in your head. Mm. And if you're just in the experience of life, then it's flow. And that's honestly why people say things like running is my meditation or cycling is my meditation right. or gardening is my meditation. It's because they're having an immersive experience of life where they're not stuck in their head.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
what people tend to think is because that's so different from what I normally experience, that must be meditation. Mm. And what I'm quick to point out is it's wonderful, but it doesn't mean it's meditation. Mm. What I think the beauty of meditation is, and we can talk about this in the physiological basis why I can make this claim, is that meditation, if you commit to it as a daily practice, you will discover that more and more of your life becomes like what you're like when you're running or gardening or cycling.
Yeah. Yeah.
Like being in line at the grocery store can be a flow state if you're not worried about stuff.
Right. Yeah.
If you're not, you know, so.
Do you think it's possible to live from a place that's constantly in flow where you are fully present? Or is there times in life where it's possibly important to worry about the future?
Yeah. I think it's all about relevance, right?
Okay.
I mean, yes. So constantly, no. The greater percentage of your life in flow, absolutely. Mm-hmm. But that doesn't mean that there isn't time to plan. That doesn't mean there isn't time to look back at the past and analyze.
Yeah.
There are absolutely times for that. There are times to employ this amazing tool we have called the intellect to do those things. However, I think that what a lot of people suffer from is misuse of that tool. Mm. Right? We constantly in our heads, mm-hmm. You know, worrying about something in the future that may not even happen, stressing ourselves out, or rehashing the past. Mm-hmm. And there's a difference between analyzing the past and looking for patterns that you can learn from and rehashing the past. Mm-hmm. We've all been there.
Yeah. Yes.
So we understand the difference.
Yeah.
Believe he brought that, you know, it's like that, dude, you're not doing any good work there.
Right. Yeah.
Or worrying about the future. You're walking somewhere and you're like, if she didn't bring my purse, she told me she brought the purse. I think she stole the purse. I think she's really good. Every time I say to bring it, she forgets it. Right? Okay. I'm sorry. That's not productive work.
Right.
That's not, that's just speculation. That's not planning. That's not looking into the future. Mm-hmm. And so it's really a question of relevance, you know, mm-hmm. are you using those critical analytical skills to good purpose? Mm-hmm. Or are you driving yourself crazy?
Yeah.
And what I find is that just in my own life, and I don't like to talk about me all the time, but sometimes we can only know our own experience directly. And so I hear a lot of things from students, but in my own life, you know, when I went off to be a meditation teacher, which the final piece of that was an almost 4-month stint away from my wife and son. We had one at that point. We now have two in India to do crazy stuff like meditate for 12, 14 hours a day and mm-hmm. learn stuff in Sanskrit and, you know, insanely difficult experience. When I was going off to do that, my best friend took me to a baseball game as an intervention. He was like, dude, this is the worst midlife crisis I've ever heard of. Just go to Burning Man with me again.
Yeah.
I was like, no, this works for me. And he wanted to know what I meant by that. Mm. And so I gave him three reasons. I said, well, I apologize a lot less these days.
Yeah.
He goes, oh, that'd be nice. And I said, and I sleep a lot better. He's like, that'd be nice. And I said, and I have about 90% less brain chatter. Mm. Just not stuck in my head all the time. He goes, mm-hmm. that'd be nice. Mm-hmm. And so those first two I put down to stress. And we'll talk about stress in a little bit. Mm-hmm. But you know, when you're not stressed, you tend not to say or buy or drink or throw that thing that you're going to have to apologize for.
Right.
So I didn't apologize as much. And stress also is the thing that ruins our sleep. Mm-hmm. Ironically, stress, sleep is the body's first line of defense against stress, but it gets compromised by stress. And so we kind of puts us in a pickle. So I was sleeping better. But that part about just 90% less brain chatter, I used to constantly be in my head. Uh-huh. You know, I looked happy. If you met me, you'd be like, that's a happy guy. But inside I was like, you're an idiot. I'm an idiot. The world sucks. Right. While smiling.
Yeah.
And so that experience of having 90% less of that is my working definition of being more present, of being mm-hmm. more in flow. Mm-hmm. And that was I was able to come back to that state of consciousness. Cause like I said, that's what I think little kids are in, through meditation. Mm-hmm. And it was not because I was trying to be present. It was just, it opened up my ability to be more present.
Yeah.
Without trying. And I think that's the really important point, because if you're trying to be present, you're not.
Right.
It's a great intention. Mm-hmm. Like if you're trying to have a great conversation, like you and I may have sat down and you may have said, you know what? I'm going to try to be a great podcast host. You know what? I'm going to try to be a great podcast guest.
You're right.
Right. But at some point, if you're really going to deliver on that idea, you have to stop trying.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So. Couple things. I'm curious about the jazz, what mm-hmm. you mentioned about that. I started taking piano lessons and my piano teacher, she gave me, we went out and saw a jazz band. I had no idea what I was going. I was like, this is so out of my realm. But it was fascinating because she described the cool thing about jazz is how they improvise so quickly, yet they're still in harmony with each other. And it was just fascinating to watch that be played into action and mm-hmm. just how much fun they were having on stage.
Yeah.
And just the pure joy of playing with this music and having like maybe little hiccups, but improvising with those little hiccups and just kind of going, literally what you're saying with like
going with
the flow. And I think one thing, at least for me, is that concept of play keeps coming up with, just like either with work or with anything like that, that flow mm-hmm. concept has this essence of play, kind of like what a toddler has of just like, they're learning, but they're playing through that. Do you have anything to add about the importance of playing?
Absolutely. So play, watching a bunch of kids play is total flow. They roll from this game to that game, and now you're a monster, and now I'm the monster. And they're just, but I think it comes from, and you're right, there are little hiccups here and there, and little
points,
but there's not judgment.
Yeah.
There's not judgment. There's not, you screwed up. In fact, I think, you know, back to a jazz scenario, you know, improvisation is not about control.
Uh-huh.
It's not about inserting my ideas. You're throwing ideas out there, but other people riff on them, you're co-creating in real time. You know, I went through improv workshops when I was in LA, and I had always been sort of a witty guy, funny, sort of sarcastic, witty guy. And improv was the opposite of that. When you're being witty, there's a distance between you and what you are commenting on. Improv was just throw something out there and trust that the people around you are going to do something with it, and then you'll have a chance to respond. And it's about not making mistakes. Like, you know, there's a beautiful principle in improv. It's called yes and. And it's the idea of, you know, if you walk into a scene and say, oh my goodness, Colonel Mustard's just turned into a giant chicken, then someone in the scene is going to go, yes, and I'm hungry. It, the worst thing you do in improv is go, no, wait, a chicken? What are you talking about? And I think that yes and approach is a really good way to live life.
Yeah.
And there's a great story. And if your listeners want to YouTube this, look up Herbie Hancock, Miles Davis. You can't, you know, story. Herbie Hancock, Miles Davis story. If you do it the other way, Miles Davis, Herbie Hancock, it doesn't come up.
Okay.
But Herbie Hancock is telling this story, and he does a much better job than I will, but I'll just do a short version. He was playing in a band with Miles Davis, who was this great, and it's an improv section. And Herbie played a note, a chord on the piano that was just wrong. And it was so wrong that he pulled like a little T-Rex. He pulled it off the keyboard, like, phase. And he couldn't even play. And he says, Miles paused for a millisecond, such a small pause that only the musicians in the band would be aware of it. Mm. Because one of the things about being in flow is you're hyper perceptive.
Yeah. Yeah, let's talk about that after this.
And Miles then played some notes that made Herbie's mistake right. And he was so blown away by the fluidity with which he could do that, the mastery with which he could do that, that he couldn't even play. He sat out for the next, 12 bars of the song and then rejoined. And afterwards, he went up to Miles in the dressing room and was like, "Hey, man, I'm really sorry about that." And what he realized in conversation, he goes, "Miles didn't hear it as a mistake."
Yeah.
He heard it as just an event, something that happened. Mm-hmm. And it was his job, his role to include it in what was happening. Mm-hmm. Well, and that idea of it's not a mistake, mm-hmm. Which means that when you're in flow, there is no judgment. Mm-hmm. It doesn't mean you're not engaged. That's the misperception. You don't have to come from that judging standpoint. So yeah, I think that's, and it's play. Yeah, everyone's having fun when they're doing improv.
Yeah. So do you think because you mentioned about, I think it was the second type of meditation, the contemplation where you have like a guided.
Yeah.
What is it?
Contemplative practice
where you have like guided meditations about like, I think that's where you mentioned
forgiveness or abundance.
Yes. Yeah. Yes. So with what you just said about not seeing it as a mistake, but including it and just playing with it and going with the flow of it, is that an act of forgiveness right there, of just not even seeing it as a mistake, but somehow incorporating it to benefit the outcome of them playing?
Yeah, no, I don't think of that as forgiveness. I don't think, because there's nothing to forgive.
Got it.
Miles didn't have to forgive Herbie for that. Herbie had to forgive himself for that. He processed the mistake.
Okay.
But yeah, so no.
Okay.
But I want to talk, it's interesting because, I talk a lot about stress and I think stress is largely, it can be a very positive thing.
Right.
In fact, you're getting stressed in a legitimate situation. And there's a, when you're stressed in a legitimate situation, that can be a flow state. Like, when you're fighting a rival for a mate or running away from a tiger. Or in my own personal experience, I was in a car crash.
Yeah.
And I was in this terrible car crash and I experienced the entire thing in a flow state. I heard a car screeching. Mm-hmm. I remember looking up, I seen this Cadillac hurtling through the intersection. Mm-hmm. And I was in my little Toyota Corolla and I just said, "You're going to be hit. Breathe out, relax." And I saw the impact. I felt the impact. I felt the force of the impact. I saw the paint flaking off the metal of the inside of the window well.
Uh-huh.
And the door getting pushed in. I remember thinking if my friend was still in the car, I had dropped him off about 10 minutes earlier. I said he'd be dead. Then I could feel the energy of the car shifting. I looked up. I could see where I was heading across the intersection. I remember thinking, you're not going to get hit by another car, but you're going to hit that light pole. Breathe out, relax. We hit the light pole. I saw the hood folding up. I saw the paint flaking off the hood. Like I saw the entire experience in slow motion and I wasn't
so
injured.
Crazy.
And and what's creepy about that, and a lot of people have had experiences like that, but don't necessarily make the leap to understand that there is that much information present every moment of your life.
So like,
Do
you think with what you just described in that flow state, your mind is able to process the future in the present moment?
Yes. Insofar as the seeds of the future are in the present.
Ah, okay.
I mean, the present is the future in the making.
Yeah.
If you want to know more about the future, pay attention to the present.
Yeah.
Because that's what's really happening. And mm-hmm. and that's leading where, and there's a really prosaic example. That people with kids will understand and people without kids are like, "What are you talking about?" When you sit down with a little kid and you see them put their glass at the edge of the table, you can absolutely see the future in the making there. They're going to knock that glass off. So someone with kids will just take it and move it to the middle of the table. In fact, after I, had my first son and was so in the habit of doing that, I would find myself doing that to my adult friends. I just reach out and they're like, "What are you doing?" I go, "Oh, sorry, my bad."
Yeah.
You're not going to knock it off the table.
That's too funny.
Very much so that the being hyper perceptive of the present moment is the best path towards having a better idea of what's going to happen in the future.
Mm-hmm.
And but that point about like, that's there's that information available all the time. I mean,
right.
There's one other experience that people have on a somewhat frequent or very frequent basis, or almost never, depending upon your orientation to these things. Sometimes when people are on drugs, they can be in a total flow experience. Mm-hmm. And everything about the moment can open up to them. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. You know, but what's interesting about that is that other things close down to them. Mm. Yeah. They can be hyper perceptive of the weave of their genes, mm-hmm. right? But not be able to do a spreadsheet. You know? Kids are in a flow state. They're super into texture. I mean, watch a 2-year-old play at the beach with sand. I mean, it's right. Total flow. Mm-hmm. I mean, they're just like, so, I mean, there's so much information and interest there, mm-hmm. But they're useless. They can't do anything, you know, in the world.
Right.
So I think what meditation allows for us is to retrain the brain, is to strip away the stress that keeps us out of flow,
right.
So that we can be more in flow at the present moment. We can be more like a little kid or playing like a jazz musician, mm-hmm. but still be functional and engaged in the world.
Right.
Right. And that may be a better answer to, or expanding on the answer that I gave earlier about why meditate. Like, what does it really do for you?
Yeah. So you mentioned how like time kind of almost slowed down as you're processing mm-hmm. what was happening to you during the mm-hmm. car accident. And I know there has been times in my own athletics where seconds seem to slow down. Mm-hmm. And it was just like this long journey during like splits of seconds. Yeah. Can you elaborate what's going on?
Absolutely.
When that type of stuff happens, and is it possible to create that when you're not in that possible fight or flight position?
Well, again, so it depends upon if the fight or flight is relevant.
Okay.
When fight or flight is relevant, you can be in absolute flow. You're not uh-huh. thinking about what to do. Your body is taking over. Your mind is reacting. You're making very quick decisions when uh-huh. you're But here's what happens when you're stressed out and there isn't a tiger in front of you, or there isn't a car you have to lift off a baby.
Right.
Because your body is all charged up with all of this adrenaline and cortisol. It's shifting into that hyper-perceptive mode, but there's nothing that it can be directed towards.
Mm.
It's distracted and distributed in like Facebook and this and that and worry and anxiety. Mm-hmm. Right. So it's when stress is irrelevant that it creates the opposite of flow.
Got it. Okay.
But speaking more specifically to this timeless.
Yeah.
Right. So there's a couple things I'll say about that. We subconsciously measure the passage of time by how many thoughts we're having. It's huh. why the phrase time flies when you're having fun makes any sense. Because
right.
when you're having fun, when you're in flow, when you're just absorbed in some activity, you are not thinking about your mortgage or your relationship or did you put money in your meter or any of the millions of things we can plague ourselves with.
Right.
We're not filled with negative self-talk. We're not running ourselves down. We're not running the world down. We're just, and when we're in that experience, we have thousands of fewer thoughts
mm-hmm.
than when we are worried and anxious and distracted.
Mm-hmm.
So we have an experience of time where time seems to fly by. When we meditate, we can experience states of consciousness. And I think even when we're in that flow experience that you talked about, when, you know, seconds can become, you know, when you're in that experience, this is going to sound ridiculous, but actually time does not exist when you're mm-hmm. in that experience. It's not even that it slows down or speeds up. It literally doesn't exist. And the reason for that mm-hmm. is because time doesn't exist. Right? Time is an abstraction. There is no time in the universe. There's a beautiful book by Carlo Rovelli, a quantum loop gravity theorist, at the very edges of our physical understanding of the world. And he has this beautiful book called The Order of Time. Mm-hmm. And yeah, time doesn't exist. There's no such thing as a past or present or a future in the way we normally experience it. Time doesn't flow, right? We have these experiences, and he talks about why we have that experience. But when you are in a state of consciousness that is beyond abstraction, then time doesn't exist in that experience. And so, yeah, a second can feel like an hour.
Mm-hmm.
Slow way down. Dreams are another great example.
Mm-hmm.
You know, people can have an incredibly long dream and be able to tell you, it would take them 20 minutes to tell you what happened in the dream. And you go back and look at their sleep chart, they were in the dream state for like 45 seconds
mm-hmm.
and had a story which to them took a year in consciousness. And so, yeah, when we're having that experience, time is just isn't even present at that point.
Right. Yeah. Going off of dreams, I'm curious with, I don't know if you had vivid dreams before you started practicing on a regular basis, but did meditation train or change your dreams when you would sleep at night?
It did for a while. It was crazy. It was like, that worked itself through. And now I think my dream experience is probably back to what it was. But yeah, there was a time where it was like, I was having these crazy dreams all the time. It was really fun. Like, I didn't have a lot of sleep. And even when I had a scary dream, you know, I don't know, maybe it's just me, but I never really, I always was able to understand something was a dream. And I didn't really carry that over into, whereas my wife, you know, she'd have a dream, a bad dream about me and wake up and be mad at me.
Oh,
I'm like, I didn't do anything. It's your dream. Like, you know, I never translated dreams into the real world in that way.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, it was actually really fun. It was like, wow, wonder what's going to happen tonight.
Mm-hmm.
And then that went away. It goes back and forth. I think there are things, I'm just starting to do a little reading on that.
Yeah.
About, you know, what we can do to remember our dreams more, or are there things that we can do to stimulate dreaming?
Uh-huh.
One thing is, you get older, you have less REM sleep generally, and REM sleep is really good for ideation and creativity. And so
right.
You know, you really want more of that. So I'm kind of interested in that as a topic.
Yeah.
So I'll probably fill you in more when I see you next.
Yeah, that'd be great. Cause I, just with my healing process, there has been times in my life where I don't even want to fall asleep because of the nightmares that I see. And I get a very visual body experience sometimes with my dreams. And it's interesting with doing more of the Vedic meditation now again and getting back into that routine, I've noticed my dreams haven't been as vivid or as physical experience. So I was just curious if like it had some type of effect for you with that as well. And I guess with me, meditation is almost like this washing of the brain. And I can tell the days.
That's actually a great way of describing it. Yeah.
Yeah. Cause like I can tell the days that I didn't meditate, like this past weekend, I was out with friends and we went to a concert and I was like, oh, I don't want to meditate in front of my friends. It's just too weird for me right now. Like we had this small like Airbnb where we're all like sleeping on couches. It felt like back in like college or something. But I was like, this is just too weird for me. I'm not going to do that yet.
Yeah. You'll get, you'll get to the point where it's not weird. You're like, I'm going to meditate. And people are like, okay, cool, Anna.
Yeah. So anyway, but that night when I got home, I was just like, I can't fall asleep. And I was like, what did I do different? I was like, oh, I didn't meditate that day and I didn't exercise. And so those two go hand in hand for me of just like, my mind is full of my thoughts. And there was another guest on the show who talked about how your thoughts create the tension in your body. And I could feel my body like tense up. Mm-hmm. And just because I couldn't relax because of all the thoughts that were rambling through my head.
Yeah.
That's why I couldn't, or I struggled to fall asleep.
Yeah. Well, it gets more nuanced than that. So
okay.
Your mind and body. So people often talk like that there's a mind body connection. And I think that sometimes they think of it like there's a trailer hitch or something. You've got to mind up to the body. Right?
There's actually a
connection, but it's such a distributed connection that when you get into it, you realize that there is actually no connection because there's no separation between your mind and body.
Yeah.
But what we do know is that I can have an angry thought and create angry body chemistry, blood chemistry, and muscle tone within seconds.
Mm-hmm.
I can trigger the stress response by thinking about something.
Mm-hmm.
So, and then what I also know is that I can use my body in a way that then affects the mind, right? When my body's all jacked up on stress chemistry and fear chemistry, or let's say I inject something into it, like, you know, if I suck down too much caffeine, then it will make my mind very jittery because the body's jittery.
Mm-hmm.
And so the mind can affect the body can affect the mind. And depending upon the path on which we're moving, that can become a very vicious cycle.
Mm-hmm.
Right? And so we have this notion of triggering the stress response. And the more I do that, then the easier it is to get more stressed. It goes that way. There's also a response that's the counterpoint to the stress response called the relaxation response. In fact, when Herbert Benson, who was a scientist in the late 60s and 70s, actually he was a scientist. He still is a scientist. But he started studying meditation in the late 60s and into the 70s and 80s. In 1975, he wrote a book called The Relaxation Response, in response to his studying this flow approach to meditation. Because what he found is that this, more than other things that he'd been studying at that point, more easily and quickly and reliably triggered what he discovered to be the relaxation response, which was nature's antidote to stress. Right? What he found is that, you know, while we all know that the stress response, you know, if this is us sort of moving in this neutral attitude toward life, then something can happen and we can flip into fight or flight. Mm-hmm. And it was thought that you just had to wait a while for that chemistry to sort of leach itself out until you could go back to normal. And he said, well, that doesn't make any sense. Like, animals don't work that way. Little kids don't work that way. Little kids could be throwing a tantrum. You're like, hey, here's a bouncing ball. They're like, oh, fine. They immediately switch.
Right. Like, yeah.
You know, I was just taking Falcon for a walk this morning. And, you know, he got into a little skirmish with another dog. And animal ferocity terrifies people. It's like, ah. And yeah, then the moment it's over, they're like, throw the ball.
Yeah.
People are like, oh, you know, oh God, yeah, I think I'm traumatized. And they're like, well, you know. So you can do that to yourself. Mm-hmm. What Benson found is that animals, and we're animals, can also trigger the relaxation response, which can just as powerfully tip you back into a neutral attitude. And so I forget where I was going with all this. I know I wanted to talk to something about, you were talking about your dreams and stress, yeah, when you're exercising. You know, the body wants to heal itself.
Yeah. Yeah.
And the body tends towards healing. Mm-hmm. It has amazing systems that are designed to bring you to health and wholeness. It's called, yes, the parasympathetic nervous system. Mm-hmm. And those are the systems that flush your brain of toxins when you're sleeping or at rest. Mm-hmm. The body wants to heal itself. So if, yeah, when you're sleeping, you've got scary dreams coming through, I would say that's the way the body's working things out.
Yeah.
You know, mm-hmm, sometimes in meditation, we've talked about, you can have unpleasant body sensations, yep, and emotions coming up. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. You're not getting fearful. You're releasing fear.
Yeah.
But we can experience that. And if there's a part of us that says, oh my God, I shouldn't be afraid, I'm meditating, you know, then it's a way of holding it in.
Yeah.
Sometimes when people get massages, they cry on the massage table. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Nothing sad about getting a massage. And it's because they're not getting sad. They're releasing stored sadness.
Right.
And so that's the way I tend to look at those things. Like, did I have a really terrifying dream? Well, then there's a really important reason why that needed to come up and out of me. You know, yeah, in the same way that, you know, if you've ever done a cleanse, mm-hmm, you make some pretty gnarly poos.
Yeah.
You know, no one says, well, Jesus, I'm not doing this again. Clearly this isn't working. Like, no, clearly it's working. It's just, yep, disgusting.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. It's just the cleaning process. Yeah, exactly. So, going back to some of the other types of meditation stuff that has come, uh-huh, up for me that we've talked about, I remember the first week I was pleasantly surprised. I feel like that first week with the in-person stuff, I had like all spectrums from sadness to ignorance to, mm-hmm, future. And I remember there was one meditation where I had lost my glasses and I don't remember how I found them in the meditation, but I found my glasses. And at the end of the week, I found my glasses in the most random spot, but I was like, oh, but it was one of those weird things where I was like, I had this weird confidence of like, I'm going to find my glasses this week. Mm-hmm. And I did. Do you have anything to add about how, kind of how we talked about a little bit about the present moment has the seeds for the future?
Yeah.
And how meditation sometimes could possibly lead us to those things.
Well, did you remember in meditation where they were, or did you have this idea that you were going to find them?
I just had this idea where I was going to find them. Like I just like the meditation, I saw myself finding my glasses. I don't remember where I was or where the glasses were, okay, or anything like that. Sure. It was more just like the event of it.
Because both things can happen, right?
Okay.
Both things can happen. So let's talk about what you experienced first. So when you lose your glasses, let's put it this way. I own glasses. Mm-hmm. I have lost them thousands of times. Mm-hmm. And I have found them thousands of times. Mm-hmm. Right? There have been a few times where I've lost them and not found them. Mm-hmm. And so just from a probabilistic standpoint, you can be quite certain that if you lose your glasses, you're going to find them. Mm. Because it's happened the vast majority of times. But when we are stressed out, mm-hmm, we automatically tend to negative interpretations of common experiences, right? I'm never going to find my glasses. And it's like, why do I have that assertion? It's because when we're stressed out, our body is primed for fight or flight. We automatically leap to the worst possible case scenario.
Yeah.
It's when we're stressed out that we're so willing to be offended. It's when we're stressed out, we're so unwilling to give an inch in traffic because that person wants my lane. Like, your lane? Like, it's a public street. Like, it's just as much their lane as your lane. But when we're conditioning our body with cortisol and other stress hormones, then the natural tendency of the mind is to go towards the negative, to go towards the hostile. And so, yeah, so if you're convinced you're going to lose your glasses, you've lost your glasses forever, and you're trying to beat yourself up, it's just a sign that you're stressed out. And so in meditation, we can reduce stress. In reducing stress, then the more common and clearly accurate way of interpreting the situation is like, oh, I just have, of course I'm going to find him at some point. So that's one way of thinking about that. What else has happened is sometimes I've been in meditation and suddenly I can see in my mind's eye exactly where my keys are. Or I can see exactly where something is, or I get some crystalline insight or clarity into a relationship or business idea. And it's because, yeah, in meditation, I can clear away. And I don't mean that as an active thing, because as you and I know, I'm not trying to clear anything away.
Right.
But what can happen in meditation is I can settle. That's a better way to say it. I can settle into an experience of clarity. I can allow my awareness to settle through those busy, noisy, worried layers of consciousness into an experience of that state of consciousness where insight and clarity arise from. And so in that space, it's not uncommon to then like, oh, you know, it's not unlike when you're lost and you're trying to read a map and you need everyone to shut up so you can read the map, because it's hard to focus on the map when you've got all this noise chattering in the background.
And, right.
You know, look, your eyes and your ears don't, but you need clarity sometimes to be able to process. And so I think meditation allows that clarity, and I can see exactly where my keys are, or I know exactly where I left my glasses. So I go and I find them. It's simply because I've had an experience of that state of consciousness in which clarity is possible.
Yeah.
But either of those can work, and both are good.
Yeah. Yeah. But I want to go back to what you were talking about earlier about how the body naturally wants to heal. And what do you, so with that, not just like heal physically, I truly believe our body wants to heal naturally from some of the traumas that have occurred in our life. And just from my own healing process, I believe that I've healed in a very organic way. Yeah. And what stops us from healing in that organic way of allowing the body to lead us to that healing process?
So a couple things can stop us. We can continue to revisit the trauma and re-traumatize ourselves. You know, there was a study that was reported in, I think, the Wall Street Journal of all places, that showed that the tendency of women in, you know, close intimate relationships or in small peer groups to rehash emotional trauma, especially in relationships, was not exactly healing. Basically, and I used to go hiking a lot when I lived in LA in the Santa Monica Mountains. And I remember once of walking up the path and coming down the path with these three women. And one of them was in the middle going very animated, very talking, very angry. And the two next to her were just going, And I'm like, oh, some poor dude's going down. Like, he didn't even like, he's going to come home. Hey, honey, what's going on? You know what's going on?
It's like,
she fired herself up. About And so we can re-traumatize ourselves by either staying in relationships that are unhealthy, staying in work situations that are unhealthy, staying in living situations where we're stimulated in a way that triggers us and doesn't give us a chance to heal. But at the same time, if we create space, and meditation can do this, therapy can do this, a good friendship can do this, being in nature can do this, if we create space where we feel safe and we can unstress, then the body can begin to let those things go naturally, because that's what wants to happen. That's catharsis. Catharsis is a natural process, but for catharsis to be enabled, you have to feel safe. And you generally have to have some physical intervention like deep rest or tapping or EMDR or something. You know, no one opens up to a therapist they don't trust.
Right. Nobody. Yeah.
So if you're in a situation where you don't feel safe, then you're not going to heal.
Yeah.
And you're not going to be able to move beyond it. You're not going to let go. And so, yeah, both of those situations, but that's, yeah, we can block the healing process. Mm-hmm. You know, it's sort of like if you have a scab.
Yeah.
And this is a really good analogy because, you know, scabs are unattractive.
Uh-huh.
My wife got a nice gash on her arm and we were going out to a nice dinner and she'd wanted to wear this strappy sleeveless dress, but she's got this ugly scab on her arm. So she wore something else.
Oh,
uh-huh. She didn't want it to be visible, but you know, and so that's an accommodation. She could also say, well, you know what? I got to get rid of the scab and rip it off.
Yeah.
That's clearly not going to work.
Right? It's going to get an ugly.
The scab is ugly, but it's part of the healing process.
Yeah. Yeah.
And so a lot of times when people don't understand that something like crying in a massage is healing or feeling sad and angry in meditation is healing, mm-hmm. then they'll suppress that.
Mm-hmm.
They'll prevent that. They'll bottle it up. They'll hide it, which is a way of ripping the scab. Like, or, you know what I mean? The analogy is not
right.
But they get in the way of the healing process because they find it ugly and uncomfortable.
I always, this may not be the best analogy, but I always think of constipation. Like when you suppress those emotions down, you're just making yourself emotionally constipated.
I totally agree.
And your constipation is like the worst feeling ever. So.
Yeah, and that's no fun, right?
Yeah.
And then of course, you know, and then there's so many things to do with that. You know, there's right. You can only poop at home, you know, and it's like, I'm like, wow, I hope you don't travel for business.
Right. Yeah. One last question about safety, and this goes back to the flow state. Do you believe that your body needs to feel safe to be in flow?
Yeah, absolutely. Well, yes and no, right? Obviously, okay. We talked about how if a tiger's in front of me or a snarling dog and I have a stress reaction, that's pure flow.
Uh-huh.
It's not because I feel safe, but it's because the reaction is relevant to the situation I'm in.
Yeah.
I'm screaming at my phone and I don't see a cyclist and I run them over.
Uh-huh.
That's not relevant. That's not flow.
Right.
Flow is, if anything, flow is a very relevant state, right?
Uh-huh.
When a jazz musician is trying. And so, yeah, if I can make that correction, but yeah, I think that, yeah, nobody is able to achieve a flow state generally if they feel unsafe. Like if you're a jazz musician and, you know, like rap is a flow state, free flow rap, freestyle rapping is a flow state. I don't know if you've watched 8 Mile, mm-hmm. the movie with Eminem,
mm-hmm.
you know, he clearly has a lot of potential. He has a lot of ideas and he gets on stage and he's terrified to be on stage.
Mm-hmm.
And so he dies, he bombs,
mm-hmm.
but then he moves through that in the rest of the movie. He gets onto stage again and he flows.
Right.
Because he's more comfortable in that space. He's finally, you know, and so, yeah, I would say, yeah, fear is a big inhibitor of flow. Fear is a big inhibitor of a lot of things.
Yeah. So last question, and then we got to wrap it up. What are some steps that you, besides meditation, that you have found helpful to create that safety for you, for yourself, or for your other people that you work with to help stay in that flow sense?
Reducing stress,
uh-huh.
right? Recognizing when I'm getting stressed, recognizing when I need to meditate, recognizing when I need to make adjustments to my life to remove irrelevant stressors
mm-hmm.
From my life, realizing that there's no, you know, like I'm not supposed to do anything. I'm not supposed to be a meditation teacher. I'm not supposed to be a career director. Mm-hmm. When I was that, you know, we have these ideas of how things are supposed to be. And then the reality is there's a way things are going.
Mm-hmm.
And I can flow with life or I can fight against life.
Mm-hmm.
Or I can create a situation where I'm stuck like in an eddy.
Mm-hmm.
You know, with some leaves and a broken stick and a dead possum and just circling around, life's going nowhere.
Mm-hmm.
But it's there. I think there's a mistake in fact, I was just talking to a guy about this because there's this notion of flow being easy breezy, lemon squeezy, 24/7 bliss. And I'm like, no, flow isn't frictionless.
Yeah.
It is friction. Life is hard.
Mm-hmm.
Right? It's not supposed to be easy. If it was too easy, we'd create trouble for ourselves, right?
Mm-hmm.
Have something to work against. If you think of a river, Which is a great metaphor for flow.
Right, yeah.
There's friction in a river. Where? At the bottom and on the sides where the river is expanding.
Mm-hmm.
So there's always going to be friction in those areas in which we're growing.
Mm-hmm.
Right? You're taking piano lessons. It might be fun.
Oh, it's so frustrating.
Because you're growing.
Yeah.
So there's that notion of, you know, we don't want a life of pure ease and contentment. Mm-hmm. That's like Richie Rich. I mean, the most boring story in the world is the little rich kid that had everything and then got more.
Yeah. Right?
Yeah. No one wants that story.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's just recognizing that, yes, life's going to be hard. There's going to be challenges. I'm going to get frustrated. But that doesn't mean that things are wrong. Mm-hmm. You know, there's this balance point between where you can begin to recognize, like, you know what, this is getting a little too frustrating. I'm butting my head against the same obstacle again and again and again. Maybe it's time for the river to move around the obstacle,
mm-hmm.
around the obstacle. And I think that just comes from awareness.
Mm-hmm.
And I think being more aware of what's happening in your life and in your body and in your mind, which is, mm-hmm. again, something that meditation trains for,
right,
is why I think it gives you that flexibility.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So, yeah.
Awesome. Well, thank you so much. This has been a wonderful time talking to you, and I look forward to having you back in Seattle. For those who are listening who live in Seattle area or San Fran area, that's where you're based out of, right?
Mm-hmm.
Do you have any upcoming workshops in San Fran area?
I do. I have a workshop next week, an intro workshop, and then I'm teaching a class the first week of June, probably teaching another class later in June. But the best thing is I have a couple of websites, and I just put this in the show notes.
Yes,
but
we will.
My main website, I'm soon going to have one big website. Right now I have two.
Okay.
VedicPathMeditation.com,
uh-huh.
which has been my site for a number of years. And on that site, I offer my live trainings and live Vedic courses. I also have a link to my online course site, which is flowmeditation.cc. And, but right now that's just a site where you can take this online course that I created, where you can learn the approach that you learned live, online. And you'll also learn some other things, breath work and visualization and some mindfulness exercises. And, but I'm soon going to bring all of that under the umbrella of flow.
There we go.
My plan to dominate the world through flow meditation.
Flow meditation.
To do that, I'm going to have to consolidate it as one website. But right now I have two websites.
Okay. Well, let's make sure both are in the show notes. And then those who, are you teaching while you're up in Seattle?
Yeah, I'm going to be teaching a class. I'm not sure the exact dates now because my wife and I just talked last night to set up the schedule and bring our family up to Seattle.
Yeah.
You get to meet my boys and my wife.
Yeah, that'll be so much fun.
Yeah. And so, but I'll have all the, it'll be on my website.
Okay.
It'll probably be on both my websites for a while.
Yeah. All right. So listeners, if you are interested in this type of meditation, make sure you look James Brown up with the two websites there down in the show notes. Other than that, we are going to be closing it out. Thank you, James. And for the listeners, if you enjoyed this show, make sure you share the love with the 5 stars and a comment and share it out to your family and friends. Other than that, I am peacing out until next week.